You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of June 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, after the US Senate lets the NSA spy programme lapse, for now, my guests Martin Plaut and James Boyes are here in the studio to discuss the state of debate on surveillance in the USA and beyond. Also ahead, after East African leaders ask Burundi's president to delay elections due this month, we weigh up the pros and cons of doing so. And as FIFA remains plagued by claims of corruption, we ask what could states and fans do to champion reform? And what are they really willing to do? That's all to come, and more besides, here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, 1801 in London, and welcome to my guests today, Martin Plaut, a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London, and James Boyes, political historian and author of Clinton's Grand Strategy, US Foreign Policy in a Post-Cold War World. James and Martin, welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with
Thank you.
Let's start our discussion today by turning to the United States, where the legal authority for spy agencies to collect citizens' phone records and other data expired at midnight last night after the Senate failed to pass legislation extending those powers. But for critics of the surveillance state, it's hardly a time to relax. The Senate did vote to advance the White House-backed Freedom Act, so data collection, albeit in a new form, is still likely to be approved in the coming days. James Boyes, perhaps we'll start with you.
Sure.
Give us the sort of the background to this, because it's not just a simple question of libertarians on one side and hawks and whatever on the other. It's kind of more complicated than that, isn't it?
It is. Let's not forget that the USA Patriot Act was passed in the immediate aftermath of the attacks on September 11th under the George W. Bush administration, and it was part of the largest reorganization of the US national security infrastructure since the National Security Act of 1947 had come in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War and in the first days of the Cold War. So it was a bureaucratic response to a crisis, and it was a knee-jerk reaction, and in the eyes of many people, it went far too far. It's easy to see how the legislation, the USA Patriot Act, contravened much of the Constitution and certainly the first and 10 amendments, i.e. the Bill of Rights. And that has been the ongoing argument both on the left, amongst people like the ACLU, for example, who you'd expect to be having problems with that. And on the flip side, on the right-hand side, if you will, the libertarian groups who say the best government is least government. And at this point, that is perfectly encapsulated by the statements of someone like Rand Paul, for example. What you saw overnight was an attempt which massively backfired by the Senate leadership of Mitch McConnell, who I think thought we'll have an unusual Sunday sitting, we'll put the speakers, the Senate is in a corner, and they'll have to come out and back this. And actually what happened was they said, this is not going to happen. McConnell was outmaneuvered. Rand Paul basically had led a series of filibusters previously. The clock ran down. And as a result of that, the legislation has now lapsed. But as you rightly point out, let's not get the champagne out. There is this other piece of legislation coming in. And even the National Security Agency itself weren't that worried about the idea of this lapsing because, surprise, surprise, if it wants to get around it, if it wants to do something, it will still be able to do so.
We'll talk a bit more about the detail in a moment. Martin, I just wonder, do you think that there's a question here of almost sort of fundamental American values being, explored? You've got this debate which is framed around a fear about terror, about attack. James has mentioned, a lot of this was introduced in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, a dramatic and devastating attack on its own soil. And then this fear of intrusive government, big government. Is this being played out, in this political theatre, do you think?
Well, what's strange about America is that, it's such a admirable society in so many ways. And yet it has this strange sort of element about it, which, there are people, serious people in the United States who believe, for example, that the United Nations is trying to take over the American government and has a plot to undermine American democracy. And these people are taken seriously. So, there is this kind of wacky side to America. If you can contrast what's happening in the United States with, shall we say, the situation in Britain, I don't know under which act we do the same kind of thing in Britain. Nobody even discusses it. Everyone assumes that the government is bugging you. Everyone assumes that the government is listening in on you. Nobody's particularly worried about it. So it's a strange phenomenon that in America, that the Americans, the American right, and as you say quite rightly, the American left, get terribly worked up about this. In other countries, people think, well, yeah, it happens, you know, but that we don't live in a repressive state. And in a sense, it's not so much the legislation that is the problem. It is the underlying zeitgeist of a country, that it's the spirit of a country, which really is important. Because, of course, one doesn't want to have one's phones bugged and all the rest of it. But we all know they do these kind of things. So which bit don't you understand?
I wonder, I mean, that's an interesting point. And I wonder, James, whether this isn't about, you know, any change in core values in the US mm-hmm. since the Patriot Act. Nothing that dramatic has happened in the, you know, decade and so since. But it is, as Martin says, it's about an attitude. Is it also perhaps to do with the revelations we know, you know, Edward Snowden sort of blew a lot of this stuff open? Is it to do with the rhetoric that surrounds the discussion rather than the substance of it itself?
Well, there's an awful lot there to address, quite frankly. But I think one of the challenges here is that what you've got at the heart of this is Rand Paul, who is a junior senator out of Kentucky who needs to make a name for himself because, guess what? He wants to be president of the United States. And this is the perfect opportunity, platform for him to do that. And he has, in a stroke, quite frankly, alienated most of the senior Republican leadership in the United States. He's embarrassed the Senate Majority Leader. He's annoyed someone like John McCain, for example. He has contravened pretty much every rule and regulation of the Senate hierarchy to enable this to happen. And he's accused of grandstanding, quite rightly. And as a result of that, you know, you've got to recognize that there's many people who think that he's putting national security ahead, his own priorities ahead of national security. The risk in all this, nobody particularly likes the USA Patriot Act. In fact, even George W. Bush has said that terming it that, because it would help leverage it get through. Who wants to vote against something called the USA Patriot Act? Was a mistake, and that there was elements in it that went far too far. So, you know, there's an awful lot of short-term political issues going on here. There certainly are, as Martin rightly pointed out, elements within the American society that could be viewed as somewhat paranoid. It's a very diverse culture. One of the challenges is when you talk about Americans, it's a bit like talking about Europeans, and we wouldn't, I don't think, compare people from Scotland necessarily with people from Spain or Italy. And I think that's a slight overstatement that people often too make about the United States and about Americans, which I'd probably take a little bit of an issue with. And I think we need to bear that in mind a bit more.
Martin, you know, James identified there, you know, the sort of realpolitik, you know, there's an opportunity here for Rand Paul to exploit for his own ends. Should we be surprised? I mean, this is 'twas ever thus, isn't it? Politicians jockeying and repositioning themselves, grandstanding to make a broader point. Presumably, Rand Paul will have known about the risks that James has described there, but he's elected to do this anyway. Simply an example of self-interest first?
Absolutely. And in politics, there are two ways of getting on. One is being the party man, and being Mr. Middle Ground and getting on by being nice to people. And the other way, which sometimes is more effective, and clearly he's decided to do it, is to, as you say, grandstand, James, and, you know, push your way to ground, stand on people's toes. And clearly he's decided on that strategy. I mean, I suppose when you have a community as diverse as the United States, you need to make your name, and that is your biggest problem. And clearly he's done that. I mean, I suppose if one was going to take a British example, one of the problems with the British Labour Party at the moment is that nobody's standing on anybody's toes. Everybody's tiptoeing around each other.
It's a different kind of jockeying for position,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Nobody knows what to do. So, you know, perhaps what we need here is a bit more toe-standing, and perhaps in the States a bit less.
Yeah, what you're finding, I think, is the fact that, I mean, even today, so we've had somebody else coming out today announcing for the American presidency, Lindsey Graham, for example. Everybody's waiting for Jeb Bush to announce, quite frankly. What Rand Paul is doing is trying to make sure that he can secure what is often referred to as a Tea Party vote. He's going to be challenging someone like Ted Cruz, for example, who has been noticeably quiet throughout this debate. And to be quite honest, the more noise that Rand Paul makes at this point, opposing this piece of legislation, standing up for libertarian values, the stronger he will do within that rather niche market within the Republican vote.
Is that a strategic mistake, though?
Not from his point of view, I think.
Well, but we've talked before about, you know, the need for, you know, a realistic Republican challenger to try and not disassociate themselves with that element of the Republican Party, but to be slightly more conciliatory, to maybe adjust slightly towards the centre. Is it an error for him to sort of so squarely identify with that camp, do you think?
What he's trying to do is basically shore up his support and make sure that when that group of people who would naturally have that inclination to vote go to the poll, they don't split and go towards Ted Cruz, for example. However, that's going to do him no good whatsoever in terms of winning the overall Republican nomination, and heaven forbid, come if he was to get the nomination, which for the record he won't, win the general in the autumn against the Democratic nominee, whoever she may be.
Very nicely put. Well, I was going to ask you actually about where's the Obama administration and the Democrats in all of this? How does that sort of fit together? Because there's obviously, you know, we talk about the controversies or the things that were unpopular in the Patriot Act. It continued, and its worst excesses were not you know, tackled straight away by Obama by any means. Where do they stand on all?
Well, this is why a lot of people have referred to Obama as being the third and fourth term of the George W. Bush administration. A lot of people, I think, who thought Obama was going to come in, you remember change. We can believe in. Well, to be honest, I think what happened is what happens to a lot of challenges. It's very easy to run against the incumbent. You become, in this case, President of the United States, and you realize the full facts and horrors of the challenge that the office faces. And overturning something as contentious as the Patriot Act would have been very, very difficult. Obama clearly had aspirations about what he could do, closing Guantanamo Bay, for example, amongst others. And sometimes it's just easy to go along. And if you've got, say, the head of the National Security Agency, the head of the CIA, the head of the FBI, saying, Mr. President, it was very easy to campaign against these ideas, but we need them to keep America secure, and your first job, you swear an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. You don't want something happening on your watch. And if you overturn this legislation, that could happen. So the White House has been very supportive of this. They were very much opposed to what it was that Rand Paul had done. They'd got this other piece of legislation in the works, effectively. So if it did lapse as it has, you know, it's all going to get picked up. And the lapse, which we're talking about here, is probably going to last about 48 hours. And the powers that the NSA have will just go back to a pre-9/11 era, in which case you'll have to get to, you know, a judge to get a subpoena, effectively. And that will actually avoid the contravention of the Fourth Amendment, which the Patriot Act had impinged upon.
So, Martin, just a sort of final thought from you on this. Do you think that then it's just a question of more of the same? You mentioned this idea. There's a sort of an ease of engagement in Europe with the idea that, you know, snooping goes on, these things happen. People seem to just be rather more sanguine about it. Do you think that America still needs to go through a bit more adjustment to that process? Or do you think that because of the rhetoric, because of the nature of politics there, that, you know, we'll see more, it's necessarily more kind of adversarial, just the way it's talked about?
No, I mean, I rather admire the Americans for getting worked up about it. And, you know, it's always struck me as extraordinary that Britain is so, and other Europeans are so laid back about the erosion of their liberties or the fact that their governments think that they can tread on their liberties. I mean, I remember when the roads were closed and the Dartmouth Tunnel was closed here during the miners' strike, which was now a long time ago. But, you know, people were actually forbidden from travelling around Britain in order to, before they had committed any act. And there was no challenge to it. And, you know, it's the sort of thing that there is an ease about it, the erosion of civil liberties, which Americans take very, very seriously. And I admire them for that.
Is it because of the presence of the Constitution, this sort of incredible edifice at the heart of public life?
It's funny we say that, and let's be honest, you know, I get into a lot of trouble for this because I'm accused of defending George W. Bush all the time. Actually, what I like to try and do is actually raise historical parallels to say, hang about a second, whatever you think of W, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt who introduced internment camps in the United States for Japanese Americans who committed no crime except being born Japanese during the Second World War. It was Abraham Lincoln who abandoned and got rid of habeas corpus. It was Woodrow Wilson who basically initiated a domestic spying campaign and started opening people's mail. So this idea that what we're talking about now is anything new is nonsense. There has constantly been what you could call erosions of civil liberties throughout the United States during times of warfare or perceived threat from overseas. And this is just the latest example of that, I think.
Yeah, so, but don't touch my gun.
Got messed with Texas.
Are you saying it just doesn't matter then?
No, I'm not saying it doesn't matter at all. What I'm saying is it's always been allowed to happen. And this idea that somehow...
How you allow it to happen that people get excited about that.
Maybe, but what happens is that during times of either warfare or threat, liberties are curtailed, as they are in many, many countries. And when that perceived threat lifts, so too does the impingement on liberties traditionally.
Fascinating insights. Let's move on the Midori House on Monocle 24 and head to East Africa, where regional leaders have called for Burundi to postpone elections due this month. Their concerns have arisen amidst the violence triggered by President Nkurunziza's bid to stand for a third term in office. Their statement was made after a summit of the East African community in Tanzania this weekend. And reports suggest Burundi has indeed agreed to postpone presidential elections by a month until late July, or at least to consider doing so. Martin, maybe you sort of bring us back up to speed here. I guess it's helpful to look at why this two-term limit that's been sparked a lot of these controversies, why was that in place in the first instance?
Well, in many African countries, you have a two-term limit, and it's sort of general. That's the way countries run themselves in Africa. But routinely, African presidents, frankly, just get round it. I mean, you know, every African country, more or less, apart from South Africa, which still has very, very clear that you won't be able to do that, at least so far. But in the rest of Africa, it happens all the time, and people are utterly fed up with this. They feel that, you know, power is hogged by particular countries, by particular leaders, and that they just will hang on at all costs. Now, we have had a good example in Nigeria where, you know, you have had a president overturned, but in other countries, they go on for year after year after year. And, I mean, what has happened now has been absolutely appalling. You've had, in the protests against him standing for the third term, you had, of course, a coup attempt. Then you've now had protests continuing, which are going on right to this day. Mm. And, 27 dead, something like 200 people injured. And it is appalling. And, people are determined to make sure that this is not just allowed to drift past.
So how would you greet the news or the suggestion today that there's an agreement to at least consider postponing the vote? Is that conciliatory? Is it a positive sign? Is it just political expediency? How would you characterise that?
Well, it's a good idea, but I mean, postpone, it doesn't mean that they're going, even if it's postponed by a month, maybe 2 months, it really makes little difference. And the real weakness of the whole position is that the people who called upon him to do this are the East African leaders, people like Yoweri Museveni. I mean, he came to power in 1986. Now, on what position is he?
Are you suggesting that he maybe doesn't have the moral authority to?
Well, exactly. And the problem is, he said, "Well, you know, I was in a different kind of system. I wasn't the presidential system. I was, it was a non-party system then. And so, I've only had two terms. It's just rubbish."
I wonder, James. I mean, if you read or hear about discussions of, you know, potential delays to ostensibly democratic processes, do you always greet that with some degree of caution? Is it almost an admission of defeat when these things are postponed because it means something's rotten somewhere, something's not working?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you juxtapose what we're talking about here with what we're talking about earlier with regard to the United States, where you have a very fixed timescale. Now, it drives a lot of people at the wall. You know, we're talking about the election, which is going to take place at the end of 2016, and it's only the middle of 2015 now. But we know we're going to have a peaceful transfer of power. No one's suggesting that Barack Obama is going to cling to the White House and forbid maybe Hillary or Jeb from taking over. Whereas what we see all too often, unfortunately, in Africa, you know, there's countless examples. I mean, Mugabe, for crying out loud, you know, where do we end with that? The one thing I will think that's quite interesting is, Martin rightly references, you know, the democratic triumph that we've seen in South Africa in the last 15, 20 odd years. And yet, one of the ironies there, of course, is that you've not had that peaceful transfer of power yet, away from the ANC. And the great question, I think, and I love your input on this, is when will that happen? Because can we call South Africa a true democracy as long as it's been dominated by one party? And will that peaceful transfer take place, and how will that look? I mean, that would be something I'd be very interested in seeing.
Well, that's a huge issue, but I mean, let's put it this way. I'm 65. in my lifetime, there has been one transfer of power in South Africa. That was the transfer from the National Party to the ANC in 94. One transfer. Now, we've had a number of prime ministers and then presidents. Mm-hmm. They have been changed. But to have, that is just not a democratic system. It's just not an effective democratic system. The National Party had total control in my entire youth and early manhood. And, you know, quite frankly, now the ANC is in a similar position. Now, they are, the ANC is gradually in a weakening position. They have lost control of one of the provinces. It's likely they'll lose control of another one in the next set of elections. So perhaps not in the next election, but the one after that, you might have a real contest for power. But the question then is, with the ANC, which whose background is in, with its strong links with the South African Communist Party, is in, you know, I mean, people like Jacob Zuma, for example, were trained by the KGB. Will they reach for the KGB handbook on how to deal with elections that you don't like?
I fear we'll have to wait and see on that. I just wonder, Martin, one interesting point, you raised this question of the sort of degree of hypocrisy with certain East African leaders calling for this, these changes in Burundi. Is that a problem that there is in terms of, you know, scrutiny across the continent, in terms of, you know, regional bodies that look at this? Is there a weakness in those institutions from which it then becomes harder to, you know, derive authority or to get senses of consensus? Is that one of the issues, or are the problems on the ground rather more immediate than that?
No, that is the problem. I mean, the Organization of African Unity and now the African Union both had a problem in the sense that they seen as a club of dictators. I mean, some of them are democratically elected, but, you know, they fiddle the election. There's been an election in Ethiopia right now, I mean, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, the result was fiddled months and months ago. So, I mean, everybody knows that this takes place. And the problem is, if you look at the charter, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with the charter. The problem is the actual implementation of the charter, and that is appalling. There is, however, one silver lining in Burundi, which is that this is not an ethnic split. Now, Rwanda and Burundi have identical ethnic splits between the Hutu and the Tutsi, and so far this has not gone along those lines. And if it went down that path, then, you know, you could have tens of thousands of people dead, not just, you know, a couple of hundred, or, you know, injured and 20-odd killed. So it is vastly to be hoped that that doesn't happen. There's no suggestion at this stage that it will.
The insights there of Martin Plaut. James Boyes still with me. Tom Edwards here on Midori House. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, another small question for my guests. Can world football be reformed? Stay tuned.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now, or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Martin Plaut and James Boyes. Now to the trouble plaguing football's world governing body. As we went to air on Friday, FIFA's president Sepp Blatter was re-elected despite corruption claims surrounding the organisation, not to mention the arrest of some of its top officials, plus investigations on both sides of the Atlantic. Amidst loud calls for reform, the British Culture Secretary this weekend renewed calls for Blatter to stand down, saying all options should be considered when it came to pressuring him to resign, including a boycott of the World Cup itself. James, perhaps to you first of all, is that feasible, a World Cup boycott, a partial boycott? Could that institution survive that sort of pressure?
It depends who's involved in the boycott. I think the English FA have said categorically they will not do so alone. No individual FA or football association will do it alone. I think if there's a sense to which UEFA who have been a huge critic of the latter, and quite rightly so, were to come forward and say, organise a European boycott, so that it was no longer the World Cup. That could have implications. The question is fundamentally, and I hate to admit this, but this is going to come down to money. Is there any way possible that this is going to happen? I would love to say that there will be a democratic uprising and Blatter will be brought down by the forces of football that he's trampled all over. I'm actually more inclined to think that what will bring Sepp Blatter down is an indictment from the Justice Department and him being put in an orange suit and sent down the river, which quite frankly... I don't think I'm being libelous here. Couldn't come any sooner. Couldn't come soon enough for the beautiful game. I grew up in Birmingham, supporting Aston Villa for a long, long time for all my sins. Got me nowhere. Thank you, Arsenal. And stopped watching many years ago on the basis that the money involved in football nowadays is disgraceful. And there's been so many sports now where it's been revealed that things are rigged. Games are jigged, and this is just the latest example, I think, the latest scandal to hit the next sport. So I don't think anybody should be surprised the idea that sport has been implicated by scandal. I just think the idea that this goes right to the top, I think Blatter's missed an opportunity to walk away with any degree of I don't use the word pride, but some degree of grace. And I think as a result of this, he's going to end up ruining the day that he's put two fingers up to the world community and, more importantly, to the Justice Department. And I think he's going to face the full wrath of the US Justice Department in short order, I would have thought.
Martin, I was going to ask you whether the fans, the ultimate consumer here, the end user, if you like, in football, whether they really care about the politics behind the game. But it's interesting, I suppose, we talked about that word boycott, we're talking about sports. You know, look to the apartheid era, you know, boycotts. That showed that people did care, didn't it? And they were galvanised into action. I don't want to flippantly compare the alleged misdeeds with FIFA with that regime, of course, but it shows that people do care about, I don't know, the provenance of the sport on offer.
I don't think they care enough. I mean, they enjoy watching the girls zipping past the goalie and they, you know, and the drama on the pitch. Do they really care enough? I don't think so. And I'm prepared to bet you £1 right now that you will never see Sepp Blatter with handcuffs on. £1?
Yeah, all right, go on then.
Okay,
well, it's fighting talk, Tom's
my witness.
It might be more that I desperately would love to see it, because it would be a fantastic day for football, I think.
I think there is. I don't think fans boycotting, I don't think UEFA boycotting would do it. I think the thing that could change it, and genuinely might change it, is the position of the companies that are sponsors. Yeah. Because
so it would still be about money, as James says, but it's maybe
exactly
about who's got the really, really significant purse
because
strings.
It's people like Coca-Cola, Adidas, Visa. These are the companies that are the big payers in, I mean, together I think they pay something like $1 billion.
Over $1 billion.
Yes.
I wonder if they did walk away, is there a Coca-Cola, is there a Pepsi that steps in, or for a Visa, is there a MasterCard? Yes. Is that one of the problems?
Well, the problem is not that they would walk away because there's a question of reputational damage to them, but there's another issue, which is that these companies are likely to be threatened themselves with the possibility of being involved knowingly in a corrupt institution. Mm. And that then begins to make their chief executives feel very worried.
It gets all those expensive lawyers nervous.
Especially for the financial companies involved. I mean, Visa are up to their neck with FIFA. I mean, you can only pay with Visa at a lot of these tournaments nowadays. So from the financial idea, and we're talking about money laundering here and all these sorts of issues, the idea that Visa could be involved in that, indirectly, I should point out, as a sponsor, is very, very troubling for them as an organisation.
We're almost out of time. Just a very brief final thought, Martin. You know, talking about, you know, football, all of this sort of filthy lucre, it's compelling. You can understand why the media gets so excited. Does it sort of disappoint you somewhat that people don't get more exercised by corruption in other, you know, arenas, other theatres, maybe where it's ultimately the damage can be more serious?
Yeah, sure. But then, you know, Sepp Blatter has, on the other hand, the one thing he has done is he has delivered for the third world, for places like Latin America, for Africa. You look at all the kids who are playing on decent turf, on, you know, with proper kit, in proper stadiums. That is Sepp Blatter's legacy. And much as we may not like the way he's done it, he has delivered for the footballing countries, the poor footballing countries. And one should never underestimate what he has done for them. And while I don't like him, I have to give him credit.
We must indeed, though it pains us to do it. Thanks very much to Martin Plout and James Boyes. That's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Alice Block. We're back at the same time tomorrow. Do join us then. For now, though, goodbye.